And we thank you on this evening, those of you who are in the BBS radio audience, and those of you in the Royal Priesthood Bible Prayer and Fellowship Room. I am Kelly Seth Matt-Parnia, and welcome to the room. We are broadcasting to you live from the Moriah Storge Hoffman Leadership Conference location here in Greenville, Mississippi. And listen to this. The Bible says, in the book of Exodus, that the more Pharaoh in Egypt grieved or vexed or oppressed the children of Israel, the more they multiplied. And, of course, in the Bible, in Genesis chapter 22, verse 17, God tells Abraham that in blessing you, I will bless you, and in multiplying, I will multiply your seed, as numerous as the stars of heaven and as the sand upon the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of your enemy. Then, of course, in Psalms 127, verses 3 to 5, it says, "Lo, children are heritage from the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. They are like arrows in the hand of a mighty man." Listen to that. And they are, blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them, for they shall speak with the enemy in the gate. So we see that wealth creation by procreation is not only a positive thing from a scriptural standpoint, but also we pointed out that some people in our world, in our society, have figured out how to take that same human capital that is meant for wealth creation and work it for the benefit of the minority and exploit the gifts, abilities, and exploit Chancellor, I see you there. Exploit the life forces of people and turn what was meant to create wealth into creating poverty for certain people by stripping from them their very soul, ripping their hearts out, ripping their souls out, ripping their life. And we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight. Professor, and I affectionately call him Professor because he's 24 years old and he's definitely before his time. We've been looking at many, many things over the last few days, and we looked at what has happened in a historical context to our people over the last 500 years, all the way up until the late, the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, when the Emancipation Proclamation in 1865 was signed, and some things began to happen. And you want to give us a little perspective from the eyes of a 24-year-old, some of the things that you've been looking at, and tell us a little bit about, as you look at this history of where our people have come from over the last 500 years. And when I say that, 500 years marked the beginning of aggression of white supremacy across the planet and European colonialism as we know it, and these factors that we're talking about, because there was no slavery based upon race until that time. There has been slavery in the world immemorial, I mean, but it was the first time in history that slavery is based simply upon the color of one's skin, and it has been one of the most vicious and perhaps one of the worst types of exploitation in terms of exploiting human capital that the world has seen. So how does that make you feel? And what are some of the things that you've noticed and some of the things that you've learned as a 24-year-old? And tell us how that way makes you feel.
Okay. It makes me feel sad that I didn't learn most of this stuff I'm learning now in high school. For example, about the black codes that started in 1865 after the Civil War, which gave the Southern states, which allowed the Southern states to basically restrict African-American freedom and compel them to work in labor, the common base on low wages and debt. That right there, I wasn't taught that in my African-American classes which I attended high school. I was not taught that. Then one system that really got me sickened is the system of the carpet leasing that applies with the Black Codes Law. See, with the carpet leasing, I learned that once the black inmates in the prison was leased out to plantation owners and corporations for free labor work while the corporation will make millions off them. Prime example, I learned one corporation was the Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad Company, also known as TCI. During their time, TCI was one time the second largest steel producer in America, which they were using free labor from black inmates.
So in other words, they got rich off of free labor because of black codes.
Black codes.
This is after the Civil War.
Yeah,
and then the Emancipation Proclamation comes in, and we had a small window, like 10 years, and then we get into the Industrial Revolution, and America starts building plants and the railroad systems across the country. So we're in the Industrial Revolution. America is amassing wealth now coming out of the Civil War, which had devastated the country.
Yeah.
And now America now is getting ready to become a major player in the world.
Yeah.
And as a major economic force, military force, it is building capacity through the Industrial Revolution, and it has built and amassed its wealth, as I hear you saying,
yeah,
by free labor off of the very slaves.
And then also I'd like to add on that Alabama in 1898, 3% of Alabama's annual state revenue came from convict leasing. 73%.
73%?
73%.
What year was that?
1898.
1898. 70% of Alabama's revenue came from convict leasing programs. So the North-South Compact after the Civil War allowed the South to make black codes or black laws, and part of that was this convict leasing program for corporations, and even the whole state is using it, making its product off of the life force, the blood, the sweat, the energy moment, the very life that the Most High has given. So now this state owes its riches to what? Black labor.
Black labor
and black people. Oh, wow. That's pretty deep. Anything else you want to point out to us?
Another law that kind of shocked me was the vagrancy law that came along with the black code. Well, the new free slave was subjected, and you was homeless, you didn't have a job, you was automatically charged with vacancy, which resulted in a fine. But the fine, but most of the new free slaves were not able to afford them fine. So they were sent to prison, which helped the convict leasing.
Black, they have an excellent.
Thank you, ma'am.
And so as you were talking about this, I'm a 24-year-old.
So like I said, they had a special with a pizza, a salad,
Hello?
And a drink for
Hello?
11.
Someone, who was that
and you pick which dressing you want. Tony said, I'll try to order.
Okay, I think I've located that noise. Thank you. Someone was talking there. 559, I guess I better put everybody on mute here.
All callers are muted, and they can unmute themselves.
So then back to the subject. So what we see as we fast forward and kind of move in, because I have a very prominent civil rights leader on the phone that I grew up as my model. He's here. I have Miss Betty here, who's a grand historian who can take us back 150,000 years in this country. In what we call the sixth region of Akibalon. Akibalon is a name for Africa before they changed it to name to Africa. And she knows about the sailors who came to this land many thousands of years before Columbus and this invasion. We need to get that clear in our minds, because we've been miseducated, as Carter G. Woodson said, in terms of the revision of history, thinking that Columbus discovered America. But he actually did not discover them. Columbus got here and found the indigenous people here, and not just the what they call the Amerindians or the Amerindians, who were the Indians or the, what we call, no disrespect intended, the red man. These Indians who were Mongolian or Asians that walked across the Bering Straits and became the Eskimos in Alaska, they found here. And I don't want to get into that, because I'm not as astute, and I don't have the historical acumen. And Sister Betty, she can talk to us more about that. But they found African people here already. Dr. Ivan Van Sertima in the Olmecs and Cortez, when he went to South America. Montezuma, according to his diary, was a black man. Balboa in his diary. Christopher Columbus in his diary. Found these black people. Christopher Columbus never really set foot on the continent of North America. He was in the islands, and he got to Haiti, what it wasn't called Haiti at the time, but what we call Haiti now. And he took 20 black people back to Spain, to Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand. And that's actually how the slave trade started, between the transit, what we call the transatlantic slave trade. It was actually started with the slaves that were first taken from here to there, and then after he slaughtered somewhere between 12 and 25 million people, started a slaughter of 12 to 25 million people that began the African slave trade by issue of the Roman Catholic Church. But now, moving back to your discussion just for a moment, as we move forward from 1865 and we move out of the latter part of the 19th century, we move into Reconstruction. We get to these vagrancy laws that were passed somewhere between the 1920s or so forth, and then we get to World War II. And then World War II, something interesting happens. We hit a jolt or a bump in World War II, and then World War II is over. And so we have another slight window as a people to enter into American society, but that window quickly closes because the civil rights movement now begins, and Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, and Dr. King and Thurgood Marshall and all of these civil rights leaders now began to move forward as we move forward in this thing. So Dr. King is killed in 1968, and we get the Voters' Rights Act in 1964. King is killed in 1968. Then we have another window of opening or opportunity, we would say, for blacks to enter into society. And according to Noam Chomsky, who's a professor, linguistic professor, philosopher, and historian at MIT, over the past 500 years, in this country. We've only had about four decades or 40 years of windows to enter, to be integrated into American society, and those windows have closed. Now, when we get to the 1970s, that's another window. Something interesting happens in 1980. Ronald Reagan, who was a known racist and did not hide it, launched something called the War on Drugs, which was basically and essentially coming out of the civil rights movement through the 70s, while they were preparing to flood our communities with drugs, remove and create this situation. The government did this. Ronald Reagan comes in, and he starts a war on drugs, and really that was a law that made being black, what, a crime. He criminalized, and the massive prison industrial complex is launched. So now we have this big beast that is feeding off of a foundation of all the history that we've just discussed, that's fully organized, fully oiled, and this beast is now ready to begin to extract its capital or its product out of, now this is your government, we're talking about Ronald Reagan, I mean, this is something our government did, war on drugs. And basically, essentially, what Noam Chomsky says from MIT is that he made it a crime to be black. So once you're born, your first crime is that you're black, and that's how they've legalized the system. So there were a few, as Noam Chomsky said, privilege given to the wealthy. There are a few privilege given to the wealthy black, but for the most part, that's a caste system which is designed only to divide us further and to provide the illusion while we're being held, waiting for the massive prison industrial and complex to get big enough so that it needs enough blood to eat the rest of us. But the few that are given certain privileges and allowed to slip through are not by accident. It's not by working hard, keeping your nose clean, doing the right thing. It's not built on that. Noam Chomsky said something interesting, and I want to hear what you have to say about that. He said America was founded upon two things, two principles, and I think you know what they are. What would you say they are, and how do you feel about it?
The extermination of black man and slavery of black man.
How do you feel about that? What do you think about that? What does that make you feel like as a young man, as far as your hope is concerned, your future?
Feel like after 500 years of going through it, and it's still the same, like, how can you change it? Is it able to be changed? My solution, what I think of is it was created on capitalism. So to destroy it, you got to go be through capitalism. That means...
That's global.
That means the black population needs to put their money in black population. Like, we need to get more black bank owners. We need to get more black doctors. We need to get more black lawyers. We need to get more black. Yeah, that's the only way I see it. Because once you interfere with the money, because that was all about the capital. The capital.
Yes.
So once you interfere with that, I feel that's a way. Because I watched this guy. It was a former racist. He was a white supremacist. I watched him talk one time. He was former. He said that the reason why we is scared of y'all because they want to keep y'all divided, because we know once y'all get together and put y'all minds together we will. Basically, you would say that they know once we get together and put our minds and our money together, we can't stop.
Wow. Now, you know what I think I just heard you say is something that, let me see if I can marry Martin and Malcolm together. Martin talked about integration. Malcolm talked about segregation. And to me, those are two ends of the same stick. And I think both of those positions have to marry each other not in segregation, not in integration, but what we need to do is congregate. When people come over from other countries, they don't practice segregation, they don't practice integration, they practice congregation. By congregation, I mean they go to a community that where they are, they begin to spend their monies with themselves. They congregate with themselves. And this is a model. And then we look up and we see a Chinatown. We see a little Korea. We see a little Mexico. We see Jewtown. We see a little Italy. And we see all of these communities that have practiced not segregation. They have practiced not integration. But they have practiced congregation. And they're modeling it before us. And then we complain when they move into our neighborhoods and they begin to open up businesses and they stay with their kind. Something has happened in our psyche, and rightly so, that makes us distrust each other. We've been programmed psychologically, and we're going to talk a little bit about how to get around that by reconnecting to our histories. That's why it's very vitally important for us to reconnect to our histories, because without our history and knowing who we are, then the culture that is the dominant culture can impose any culture on us because we don't know who we are or what our culture is. And that is the whole point of wiping away your history and your identity, taking your language, taking your tongue. So the work must start. So I'm happy and I'm excited. Let me take, I see my brothers are all signed in, and I see some of you, let's see here. Your mic is open. Brother Afsar, Imhotep, your mic is open.
Good evening.
This conversation, and I'm trying to find our great historian and sister and indigenous sister, Sister Betty. I'm looking for a number here. I don't see it up here. Is your mic open?
Yes, sir. Betty. It's open, and I'm hearing you loud and clear.
All right, Brother Afsar, Imhotep. Such a pleasure to have you on the line tonight as a civil rights leader in the 70s who fearlessly, without even... You know, you said something to me earlier today. You said you when you played football, and I learned to play football watching you. You talked about something. You said you were fast, you were thin, you weighed about 125 pounds. You were scared, but you had no skill, no talent. But I wouldn't have known that the way you led us in the civil rights movement back in the late 60s when we marched and we had to go downtown. We got tear gas in our eyes. I remember running. I remember we went down to the bottom of the hill as we marched down and the National Guard turned us back around. I remember that fight as we followed you. I never would have suspected that there was anything like fear in you. So with that visionary leadership and that kind of courage and looking at a system now that has escalated itself to global mammoth proportions, the Pope went to Africa today, lambasted the leaders of Africa for their corruption and exploitation of the African people, but failed to acknowledge the devastating effects of colonialism on Africa and how they've started wars for the sake of exploiting Africa for its natural resources, and not only for its gold, its oil, its diamonds, and natural resources and minerals, but extracting the human capital, which is the greatest capital on this planet, from Africa. And European aggression and capitalism and colonialism has raped Africa and made Africa poor. And now we are groveling and looking in the teeth and the mouth of a massive mammoth beast that has an insatiable appetite for African blood and African flesh. And he's growing. And he's getting bigger. And so now, to put the perspective on what we're looking at and understanding that we're not just fighting something in an isolated pocket, but it is a global problem. How do you feel? What, Afsar, how do you look at this through the eyes? You were a leader. You were a civil rights leader. You have the experience. You know. What are your thoughts on this? What possible avenues or ways out? What hope is there for us in this system?
You know, let me give you a little background. I did not come home from Vietnam with the intention of doing anything other than going to Grambling State University. I wanted to coach football, and I wanted to teach history. But the circumstances were then, as they are now, that the most popular thing that we knew about was integration. That would be the end of all, as far as all our problems would be solved once we integrated. Once we could sit in at a table with the white folks, we could go in the front door, all our problems would evaporate. And I like what you were saying a few moments ago relative to not integrating or segregating, but collaborating and congregating. Back then, some of the problems that we had, we were victims of a system as we are now. We were victims of a system, but we could not recognize and identify that system. But now that we do recognize and identify that system, we got a paradox that we are confronted with. We must separate. When I say separate, I don't mean a physical separation, but separating from the way we think. And if we can change the way we think, we'll change the way we act. And I don't know where we would find that the strength to separate ourselves until we start teaching ourselves. It is no coincidence that some of the problem that you articulated, it is no coincidence that the Pope can go down in Africa and re-victimize the victim and say how much corruption exists there. You know, without looking at his own house, without looking at that 2x4 that's in his own eye. You know, they're just as much a part of this doggone corruption in Africa as the African are who's perpetrating that corruption. We have to understand that we got a mammoth job, a huge job before us, and that is to try to survive. We got to survive. I've listened to that young brother talking a while ago, and he's spewing a little history out there, which is a good thing. But we got to spread that. We got all kind of devices now that we can put it out there. And not only just talk about it, but be about it. You know, be about educating one. Each one, teach one. To where we can get to a point to where we can stand. You know very well that there was a place called the Front. Back before we had integration, the Front was alive with black people owning businesses. You know about the Wall Street, Black Wall Street that was in Oklahoma, back in the 20s and stuff. You know about that. And back to where we had people who were doing more with less. We've been effectively divided. We can't identify. Let me tell you what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad used to call certain people. He used to call certain people devil, and people got offended by that. And I don't think he meant that cartoon-type character with the horns and the trident and the forked tail. I think what he meant was conduct and behavior. You know, there are certain things that the devil does. There are certain ideas that the devil will promulgate, that will put out there and act upon. You know, we need to come away from that. Come away how? I don't know how. But I just know that this is something that needs to be done. I look at these brothers here, and I can see that, you know, they, I don't know, I don't want to say lost. I don't want to say given up. I don't want to say a lot of things, but you look at it and you say, now, how come everybody else can come in and be about the business of moving forward and seem like we're stagnated? And why we're stagnated, there's a whole lot of, I don't want to say it, but I got to say, a whole lot of selling out, which is historically the thing that means and maintain us in calm and peace and stuff. We don't have to get out in the street and rant and rave and hoop and holler. We don't have to do that, you know? We don't have to do a lot of things that the people feel like we must do this. No. We got to unthink some of the things that we've been thinking. We got to unteach ourselves some of the things that we've been taught. We got to undo some of the things that's been done to us. And we cannot go to those individuals who taught us that teaching and expect them to unteach us. We cannot go to those people who did those deeds to us and expect them to undo those deeds. It is our responsibility. I'm saying if you step on my toe, and you say, oh, I'm sorry, that's an accident. And then in the morning you step on my toe again, oh, I'm sorry, that's an incident. Eventually I got to come to a consensus within myself and say, no, this is a design. And I either got to put on me some steel toe shoes or I got to move, I got to do something in order to keep you from stepping on my toe. It is our responsibility. I maintain this, and I don't bite my tongue when I say it. We are God's people, but we are a hard-headed, stiff-necked people. Until we can realize and recognize that we are God's people. I don't care what you've been taught. I don't care what you've been told. I'm telling you, from years of observation and activity, we are God's people. There has never been a people to walk up on the surface of this planet Earth with the love and humanitarianism that we displayed. There's never been a people who went into the master's house and cooked his food and stuff and didn't poison him and his baby. I know back some books that I read that prior to them bringing us into the kitchen, they had the Indian women in the kitchen cooking. But a lot of them didn't eat another meal after that because they were poisoned. I'm a victim. I'm a person who fought the American war. Fought the wars until they saw our women nurse their babies and stuff when they didn't even have enough milk left to nurse their own babies. It's a special people who do stuff like that.
Now you know, if I may,
yes, sir.
The devil is here with me. Sister Tara is here. Frank is here. Earl is here. We're here at this location. We're all listening to you. And we've covered this history. And oh, man, just listening to you is such a wonderful treat for me. And I'm happy to share your story and your power, your enthusiasm with this audience here in Greenville, Mississippi. And it seems to me that we see an escalation and acceleration of a sort of end game, kind of chess game, getting ready to checkmate with some of the recent activities in the news. Now, let's try to add contextual interpretation and try to bring some synthesis between the events and connect the dots of these strategies and these events that we're seeing, that without allowing them to pass, were disconnected as non-related incidents, such as the incident that happened yesterday in San Bernardino, and these shootings and the police violence against black men in the country and black-on-black crime. Now, I don't come down on black crime as hard as some would say, well, blacks killing blacks. And the reason I don't do it is because black-on-black crime, in my perspective, from where I'm standing from, is, as Dr. Amos Wilson said, a continuation of white-on-black crime. It is a continuation, sort of like what's going on in Africa. They come in and they create a caste system, or they create a system whereby groups are divided, and then yet under the false auspices and false pretenses of trying to do humanitarian work in Africa, they stir up rival groups and tribes or nations against each other to cause them to fight, so that once they start fighting, they can come in and remove those resources. I think you hit a tremendous, as a matter of fact, I know you hit a tremendous point when you said the compassion, the depth of soul and heart that is found within the people of color, particularly in this country, even giving nutrients and supplements out of their own bodies in terms of breast milk, the mammies, to white babies. And yet we still have the capacity to love. What kind of people, who are we other than God's chosen people, as is the testimony of the fact that we have made the world rich through our sacrifice. We can be no other people but God's chosen people. And there are lots of ways to prove that. I'm proving this from the negative side of what has happened to us and how the world has profited from us. It smacks with the theology of Romans chapter 11, where the wild olive tree was grafted in and become rich because the natural branch was cut off. But then there's a warning. There's a prohibition. There's something, there's an admonition given to the Gentiles, which are the European races. In that book, in that chapter, it says, don't be ignorant, lest you be wise in your own conceit, that we would not remain asleep forever. But it is only until they themselves, and I think what we see, the rush and acceleration of the violence and the seemingly strategic strategies of trying to create racial wars, is for the end game checkmate. And what do we do? How do we respond? Now, Deborah, you're sitting here listening to this, your son, has articulated with great deal of clarity, with historic, using the disciplines of history to profile a situation. How are you feeling as you're sitting here listening to this? You're not a talker like him? Oh, okay. What about you? You don't want to talk. Oh, Frank, what do you guys think? You just walked in. You don't want to say anything. Okay. All right. So, end game. We're at end game. It's chess. The one more move is perhaps checkmate. We can see the chess pieces moving on the board with all the things that are going on in our world. How do we now, in this game of chess, and there's global war, this problem that we have, it's not just a national problem. It's not just a state problem. It's a global problem. It's a global problem. Now, Sister Betty, I hope she's there. I'm still looking for her. I don't know what number I'm looking for her number. I got the people here on the board that, let's see. I don't see her number. Chancellor, are you still there? No, Chancellor's gone. Maybe Sister Betty, are you there? Can you hear me? If you're there, please press *6 and come up in the queue, and I'll see you because
Q&A session started.
I don't see you on the board. Now, while I'm waiting for her, Brother Asar, I like to think in terms of solutions. We can get stuck in the paralysis of analysis and statistics and data and talking about what's wrong and talking about what has happened and never get around to talking about what it is we need to do. Now, let me say from a biblical standpoint, this is from a biblical standpoint, that you made a very powerful presumption and assertion that we are God's people. If that is the case, then the entire system that we're in cannot work for us at any level. Nothing in the system can work for us. No more than anything in the system of Egypt, if we're looking at the Bible, could work for the Israelites. Nothing inside of their system, not their economy, the economics, not their government, not the education system. Well, I hate to say that because I know Israel borrowed all of its culture from Egypt. It stayed there 430 years. It went in with no culture. It went in with no legislation, no education system. It came out because Egypt, but just for the sake of argument, they had to come out. If I'm talking from a biblical standpoint, nothing in the Assyrian Empire worked. Israel could not thrive in that, in the Babylonian Empire, in the Persian Empire, in the Grecian Empire, and in the Roman Empire. None of that will work. And so what I'm saying is that nothing in this system is designed to work for us. It's not designed to work for you. It's not designed to survive by your free labor and extermination. Yes.
If you're God's people, then why is it so hard on us? Why are we catching so much hell as a race of people?
I'm gonna let Brother Asari answer that.
I feel. Let me say it like this here. As you stated, unless something catastrophic happens. You know, sometimes a system or an entity can get so burdened down with excess weight. Take a boxer, for instance. A boxer walk around with 20 or 30 pounds more weight on him than he's going to carry into a fight. You got to get down to fighting weight. Now, whereas you take just that traditional, everyday, run-of-the-mill people, you know, thing that not in this system that would be amenable or friendly to them. If you are creative and God's people, you can take when in slavery time, for instance, slavery time, we were given the intestines of a hog because they were not fit for human consumption. We were given the top of a turnip green because it was not fit for human consumption. We were given all those things, and the cooks went into the kitchen and took the guts of a hog and made chitlin, took that peck of a meal and made hot water cornbread, and took the top of the green and made some turnip green, some chitlin, and some hot water cornbread. That's because we are God's people. We can take this system. The only strength we had historically, the only strength we had historically was the church. That was the only strength. We even communicated through the church. And we got to have that one thing that we had to manifest itself, to project itself, to project that we got to get away from that theology of prosperity and get back to that theology of liberation. You know, that theology of prosperity is going to benefit the few. We are, as a people, in a state and situation that we're in because we can't connect to each other anymore. We've lost that vital link that knows that the same problem that you got, I got. You know, if you look
I heard you say the communication in the churches was good in the older days. But, Mr. Assad, what has happened to the church now? You know, what is wrong now? I feel that the church is being a problem now. Explain to me what is going on with the church now.
The church has gotten away from spirituality and gotten on religion. And in religion, I'm not a prophet, I'm not a pastor, I don't know, but I'm just saying in religion, I think the scripture said man was not made for religion, religion was made for man. And in religion, you have people who misinterpreting the purpose and the intent of the scripture, using it to benefit themselves, using it to exploit. If you go back, and you're a minister, I'm not preaching to the pastor, you know, but if you go back and you look, that when the high priest, when Jesus, when they went in and told the high priest that Jesus done tore up the temple and chased the people out of the temple, the high priest wasn't really concerned about the deeds and misdeeds of the people until they started messing with the money, you know. And we got people who are leading us whose sole purpose and sole interest and desire is for money, you know. I know the pastor that I had when I was a regular church member, you know, he could barely make enough money to take care of his family, but it wasn't about that. You know, it was a tithing. The tithing served a purpose for maintaining, sustaining the churches, for helping those individuals in the community who didn't have. That was the whole concept around that. Even now when he had hog-killing time, when it was hog-killing time now, there was nobody in Homer, in the community, who didn't have meat. Everybody going to get a dishpan of meat. Everybody took their excess food, their garbage and stuff, and fed the hogs and stuff, you know. But we've gotten away from that. We've gotten down to the point where now applaud when another person is doing bad in the community. We applaud when another person is homeless in the community. If it happens to one in the community and the whole community doesn't feel it, it's only a matter of time before it's going to happen to those people in the community. And we need to be able to make that connection. You know, if the church was a linchpin that bound us to each other historically, that was the only linchpin we had. And if they destroyed that linchpin, well, then we are people that's out on a big sea without a map, without a compass, without any of those essential things to survive. And it doesn't bode well for the future. It doesn't.
Let me speak to that, having served 40 years. As a professional churchman and somewhat of a fledgling church historian, to give a flavor or a shade of historical perspective to the church, we must never forget that there was a time we were not even allowed to have church. Amen. We've only been allowed in excess of some 150 years to privilege, or 200 years to enjoy church. We were not allowed to assemble. We were not allowed to read. It was against the law. There were laws that prevented us from reading. And then when we were allowed to read or allowed to assemble or to congregate, it was under the strict supervision of those that had been trained first by the master. And there was something called meritorious manumission, which was a caste system that set up division in terms of if you did one of four things, you were given certain privileges and allowed to be over certain Negroes or certain blacks. If you save white life, if you save white property, if you invented something that could bring profit to the white community, and, or if you snitched on other blacks, then you were rewarded. So what am I saying here now? I'm saying that there's only one way for a minority of people to rule a majority of people on the planet, and that is by setting in place a caste system where some of those that are being ruled over by the minority are agents of their own people's oppression. And we've got to remove those agents. We've got to remove those images, first of all, of people in our society that have been placed there to give us an illusion because they have a semblance of acceptance or assimilation into this society by social status or economic advantage or certain privileges that they enjoy. They are there deliberately. They are there deliberately to give an illusion. They are there deliberately as agents of oppression of our own people to give the illusion that the possibility of assimilation into American society is possible while the laws and while non-participation disenfranchisement is happening. You are not a stakeholder. You're not owner in anything. You're not allowed to have a say-so over what foods, what goes into your food, who makes your clothes, who makes your medicine, and the industries of transportation. You're not allowed to be a participant at the table to decide what is the curriculum that will be taught. There's a board of regents that decides by the Jesuits what curriculums will be for colleges, universities, and schools. And most of the time, it's full of false information, misinformation, and revised information that gives the advantage to the minority. So, as far as church is concerned, the Bible says this in Matthew 23 and 13. There's only one thing that's stopping. And I want to hear what you have to say about this, Asa. It sounds almost like Asar, but it's A-S-A, Asa, Raguel, Shema, a.k.a. Robert Elijah. I want to hear what you have to say about this. Luke, Matthew 23 and 13 says that is the religious leaders that are standing in the door. They won't come into the kingdom and they won't let anybody else in. Luke 52:11-52, and I want to read this one because it's pretty powerful. Luke 11:52, brother Asar, Imhotep, it says this, and until we do something with this image, with these, and we need to talk a little bit about it, but I don't know, because I think in the pages of the Bible there's a solution that I want to get to, and it has to do with the theme that we have been talking about for the last 6 weeks, and that is wealth creation through procreation. Within the very pages of the Bible, there is a solution for us. But we can't get to it because of this reason. Luke 11:52 says, woe unto you lawyers. Now, the lawyers of that day were not the civil lawyers that we know of and we think of in our day and time. These lawyers now are lawyers of the word or of the law of Moses, the law. He said, so these are your religious leaders, religious lawyers. He said, woe unto you lawyers. Listen to it. I want you to hear this carefully. You have taken away the key of knowledge. You enter not in yourselves. And them that were entering in, you hindered. So the people that are the gatekeepers, keeping us out of the kingdom, keeping us away from liberation, keeping us away from prosperity, are the very gatekeepers themselves that have been placed into position And a historic reflection, as I've just given the definition for meritorious manumission and the history of the church, then placed in, and I'm one of them. Hold on a minute before somebody starts. And I was one of them for 40 years. So let me just fess up. I was trained to be a professional liar, and I lied well. I told it well. And I told a lie, but I didn't know I was lying. But does that give me an excuse? But how many will come away once presented with the fact that you've been lied to? How many can walk away from their salaries? They got children to feed. They have tuitions to pay. They have mortgages, rent. They have to buy clothes. They have to provide for themselves. What does life, one preacher told me, I know what you're saying is right, but I went too far, stayed too long, paid too much, I'm in too deep, and I can't come out. What you're saying is truth, but how am I going to eat? How am I going to pay my bill? So I'm saying I would rather die and sacrifice myself and tell the truth for the liberation of my people. I would rather starve and not have a paycheck than to exploit my people and feel, you know, satisfy my flesh and meet my needs, than to exploit my people for their tithes and their offerings, and then know I'm lying, and knowing that I know the truth, and knowing that I'm taking from them and preventing because I have grandchildren. And as I see this massive beast growing, the gross domestic product, and if you are the capital that's feeding the gross domestic product, and this system is getting larger and larger, at some point, your children and grandchildren are at risk because the monster is getting bigger. So those of us who come in contact with the truth have a responsibility to our posterity, not our prosperity. I was going to put that sound almost like I was still preaching in the pulpit. That's a preaching point. That kind of rhyme. Somebody can rap that. I said, we have a responsibility to our posterity, not our prosperity. And that is my position. So to answer your question, meritorious manumission, the caste system of giving some religiously a few privileges to rule over the other, and then the thing that I write about in my book, which is the Stockholm Syndrome, where you perceive the captor to have the power to take your life, and you begin to feel sympathy for your oppressor. You begin to feel sympathy for your oppressor and some kind of way, because he seems to have the power or has given the perception that your life is dependent upon him.
The oppressor?
Who?
The preacher.
Say that again.
I'm gonna say it again. Who helps the oppressor today is the preacher. If we can't start up top where these preachers at and break their back and make them do what they're supposed to do and tell the damn truth. Stop lying. Tell the truth. And lead your people better than what you're doing instead of in your damn pocket. I'm going to tell you like it is, whether I curse or not. This is the truth. You're lying to your people. You've been lying. You hadn't stopped lying. You're paying your bills off your people, all your people's blood. You need to go to hell.
So wait a minute. Brother, he throwing down the mic. Brother,
yes.
Brother,
it's
hard now. Does it sound like that, brother? On fire.
Yes, sir. I like that. Let me tell you something I like. What the young man said right then, you know, I listen to the language of our young people, and our young people be using words like, I'm kicking it and I'm chilling. I'm kicking it and I'm chilling. And I don't like that. Why? Because, first of all, I had never seen anyone die until I got in Vietnam. I had never seen that. And one of the main things that I noticed about a person who was in the throes of death is that their legs is kicking like they're trying to run away. You know, their leg, they lying there and on their way up out of here, and their leg is kicking. And then after that, they would take those individuals and put them in a big cooler, take them to grave and registration and put them in a cooler. You know, so when I hear a youngster saying that he's kicking it and chilling, that means that he's dying. And when they make certain that all his vital signs are stopped, they put him in a cooler and make certain that he's dead. So when you tell me you're kicking, you're chilling, you're telling me that you're dead. It's time to be on fire. We don't have the luxury of kicking it and chilling. We don't have, our youngsters don't have the luxury of that. You know, and it's just like what the mother just said a few minutes ago. You know, you need to stop the lying. You need to stop it. I was in Turkey, you know, and they had a movement that I'm from a small place here. You know where I'm from. I had never seen people who were so caught up behind a belief. I thought, these people must be on drugs. They must be on drugs. How in the world can these people run into armed people who are shooting them down and they constantly getting up? I had never seen a Buddhist monk who was so serious about their belief system that they would go out and douse themselves in some kind of liquid fuel or something and set themselves on fire. Ooh, these people got to be on dope. It got to be dope. But that can come a thing up on your heart. That can come a thing up on your heart.
We got about 4 minutes before we go off the air.
That,
and what I wanted to say is that within the pages of the Bible, I found a solution. One possible solution, not the only solution, because our egos get invoked. And when another preacher hears me say this, their egos are going to be assaulted because I said I found the solution. And I have. I believe I have found the solution. I believe I found the key, something that out of all of my studies, I studied Johanna Litt at Simpson College on Silver Avenue at Bible College back in the 80s. And I found something in one of the writings of John that was not taught in the school, was not taught anywhere, that I think is a possible solution. And I would challenge any biblicist, any theologian, any Bible scholar, on this one passage, and I've shared it with some of you that are listening to me now in the radio audience, and those of you that are participating on the board that have the mics that are here. I've shared this principle with you, but we're about to run out of time, and I wanted to say to Brother Asar Imhotep, to Frank, to the Earl, and to Tara, to Deborah, and to Professor, to Asa, Raguel Shema, tonight for his input and historical perspective on our problem. But I don't want you to leave here hopeless, is what I'm saying. That the story is not over. It's not checkmate. We have another move. Brother Asar, Robert, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. We're getting ready to go off the air now. It has been an absolute plum, pleasing pleasure. I am Khalid Zafnat Ahania El. I have been your host, and you have been in the Royal Priesthood Bible Prayer and Fellowship Room. And I want you to always remember this right here. As I say goodnight to you, may the light of his countenance shine through you, in you, on you, around you. And that is my prayer. Listen, good night.